And I guess it's my turn. I'm Rafael Garcia, the speaker, and I come from WPI in Massachusetts. And I'll be here until Friday, yeah. So, and looking forward to talking with you informally and formally, etc. Here's my talk, which actually, that's the second slide. Here's my first slide, and I apologize for the thing there, but something happened wrong at the last minute, and we don't have time to figure it out. Basically, you know, I'm an experimentalist. I worked for some years with Moses Chan, and most recently I'm at WPI. In the course of this talk, I'll show you some of the things that perhaps, you know, rather than just focus on my experiments solely, I figured maybe I suggest what I think, you know, are big questions as well, you know, since that's one of the purposes of this workshop. Also, I have collaborators at Brookhaven National Lab, I'll present some of the things there. And Moses Chan actually already presented some things earlier, and this is my way of making fun of his name. I think Maran was looking for something.
Laser pointer, so
yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. And also, I'd like to mention my two collaborators at Penn State. These are various students. WPI is primarily an undergraduate institution, you know, although we have a graduate program as well. And these are many students right now. This is one graduate student that's working with me, but these are all people that have worked with me in the last couple of years. Whoops. Professor Chan already, you know, for the stuff that we're dealing with helium, he already presented a very lengthy talk, apparently, on things. And so I'll just be giving a few highlights of the experiments that we did together, and maybe sort of focus a little bit more on the future or things that I consider open questions. And but, you know, if you need more details about those experiments as well, you know, feel free to ask me during the talk or afterwards, or, you know, informally, and we can talk about it. So here, you know, as I was thinking about what are the big questions or whatever that I can think of, I thought of these three as big questions, and I'd be interested if some of you guys have the answers to these. What is the precise relationship between boundary conditions and the sign of Casimir forces? Are Casimir forces observable in liquid crystalline films? And do Casimir forces cause wetting transitions? Okay, and perhaps some of these ideas may be foreign to some of you, and particularly these last two are the ones that I've been thinking of most recently, and so I'll try to show you the experiments that I've done and perhaps what I'm thinking of. Since this workshop is dedicated to Casimir forces, I probably don't have to spend too much time talking about this, but just to remind you, you know, we're looking at fluctuations inside a film that's absorbed on some solid surfaces. You know, and so certain modes aren't allowed, and because of this, there's a force that's pushing on these interfaces, the vapor interface and the liquid solid interface, and these two guys were perhaps started the whole subject when they, you know, they wrote a very simple relationship for the correction to the free energy per unit area. To the free energy of the film, and in particular this expression due to the boundaries 1 and 2 limiting the fluctuations, they said, well, this should be a function of this d over the correlation length, and they proposed that this would be the one form that would be consistent with scaling. In particular, these things are constant as you change the distance between the two surfaces, and so that when you take the derivative with respect to the volume to find the pressure on the two surfaces, you end up getting this expression here, where the curly theta is also a universal function of this ratio of the film thickness to the correlation length. Setting you up for something that I'm going to show you a little bit later, here's sort of a heuristic reasoning of how you can think of the equilibrium of basically when we did our experiments, we had plates suspended above a bulk liquid. And on these plates is helium depicted here in blue. And it had a certain film thickness d, and the distance here between the plates is much smaller than h, and so we assume that the two films are the same thickness in our experiments and calculations. And basically, here is the free energy, an expression for the free energy of the film, plus the free energy of the liquid on the surface, minus a Lagrange multiplier times the volume. Essentially saying that, well, the volume of the liquid is conserved, and so therefore we should minimize this expression to find the equilibrium configuration. And so here's a part here for the bulk liquid times the volume of the bulk liquid. Here's the surface tension of the bulk liquid times the area of the bulk liquid. Now for the film, this is the volume of the film times the bulk free energy per unit volume. Okay, that's the first expression from their theory of and here's the surface tension at the surface times the area of the film. Here's an expression for the Hammacher constant, etc. So this is the free energy, say, of the film due to the van der Waals forces. Then there's, of course, the film is at a certain height above the bulk liquid. So here's an expression of the volume, which is just the film thickness times the area of the film times just rho gh. And then here's we want to conserve the total volume of the film plus that. Well, you take the derivative and you get two expressions. One, you get that h over d cubed is rho gh, and that's just an expression for the thickness of the film. And as the film as the height increases, the film gets thinner and thinner. And the second expression is you get that this is suggestively like a chemical potential, okay, which is the same everywhere. Essentially in our experiment, that expression for the film thickness, now I use a slightly different symbol here because I have a correction here. If you throw in the full theory of that that's a heuristic expression earlier where, just to make derivatives easy to calculate, etc. If you go into the van der Waals theory, which is the Casimir force for the electromagnetic waves, you get this expression over here approximately, which shows you how you go from a 1 over d cubed force to 1 over d to the 4th force approximately. And then you have an additional expression, which is the key one, which is this Casimir force times a volume term, because we wanted to write this expression so that we just have an mgh on the other side. So the rho is m over v bar, so per atom. And so therefore what we did was we varied this height, we measured the d, and from that we back calculated the curly theta, which is this universal scaling function. And well, here's the for helium, just as a quick reminder, these are the original experiments I did way back in 97 or something, where we measured there's a dip in the film thickness near the lambda point, so the T lambda is over here, and we observed this this curious dip in the film thickness, and at the time we didn't understand it. In particular, and most recently we went back and we did some improvements on that. But this is just the big picture here of what we saw. In terms of this is for helium near the lambda point. There's another critical system that you could study, and that's say binary liquid mixture near its demixing point. And Masa Fukuta did probably the first really nice experiment for that. Back in 2005, and so there they actually see a thickening of the film. And the difference between a film becoming thinner and becoming thicker apparently was just due to the different boundary conditions, right? And so this is one of the reasons why I think that this is a big question as to, a typical thing that I've always heard people say among theorists is that, if the boundary conditions are opposite, as say one component of the binary mixture is favored at the vapor interface and the other component at the substrate interface, the force should be repulsive on the two interfaces, making the film thicken. On the other hand, for helium, well, the order parameter is the wave function of the Bose condensate, if you like, in the liquid. So those fluctuations, they have to go to zero on the interfaces. And so they say, well, these are like Dirichlet boundary conditions. They're symmetric, and therefore should be attractive. However, I have not seen anybody ever publish a proof that always when it is the same, it is attractive, and always when it is opposite, or I'll show you, and for a tricritical point, there is a weird boundary condition, okay? It's even weirder. It's not even opposite in some cases. It's weird, and still it's repulsive. But by the way, for the helium experiment, all sorts of different calculations were done. But I'll just mention this graph here because it's a very impressive graph. I actually didn't realize it when they first sent the paper out. So here's this curly theta, and here's essentially a d over the correlation length for the various experiments that we had done. The colored points are data points from that experiment, how they collapse when you plot them according to this. And the little dots are the theory, which I when they first sent this paper out as a preprint, they never, you know, they rescaled it so that they would match. I didn't realize that actually before you rescaled it, that this is how actually accurately it matched, which I think that's quite impressive. In fact, it's spooky. that it could match so well. I never expect any theory to look at that. You notice, though, that this doesn't quite match down over here. And I think this is still something that people are trying to understand quantitatively. Although, admittedly, you know, there could always be something wrong with our experiment, too. So I can't guarantee that that isn't the case. But the opposite. Sorry, yeah, I got that confused. The black, these are our data points, and then these are various film thicknesses calculated from the theory. What's that? That's right. Yeah. So from the Monte Carlo simulations. Yeah. So which is actually quite impressive that they agree so well down here, whereas over here our experiment shows a thinning that is not present in their film. And Roya and Moran have actually a partial explanation for that, but not the total. So I think that's still a thing. Well, when we did the experiment, nobody actually told us even that there should be a dip below T lambda, as probably Dietrich, when he was here, discussed. The original theory said that the dip should be at T lambda, and actually it should thicken again as soon as you went below T lambda. And so that threw us off for quite a while, and actually a couple of years of doing the experiment over and over again in various configurations, including putting the cell upside down. Which was suggested by somebody, and so we did that too to see if we can make the thing go away, and it never went away. And then finally we published this. But in any case, the other little knob that we had with helium that we could vary, after I got my PhD and I stayed as a postdoc in Moses' lab to do this experiment in particular, is that you can add helium-3. And so this is a bulk phase diagram of helium-3. Four mixtures, where here's pure helium-4 and here's pure helium-3, and as you add helium-3 to it, this dilutes the superfluid and lowers the transition temperature. Okay, and in particular, at a certain critical concentration, you get a tricritical point, and there you actually have both concentration fluctuations and superfluid fluctuations. As you added the helium-3, this is actually the raw data over here. When we did our measurements, we actually measured capacitance. And so when we plot it, we plot the capacitance divided by the capacitance when there was no film inside, no helium inside the cell. And then from this, we calculated the film thickness. And this is sort of a curious thing, you know, while you add helium-3 at 2 degrees is approximately, is almost all in the gas phase. And so basically it increases the total dielectric constant because you have this extra amount of helium-3. Once you correct for everything, actually the dip with 10% helium-3 inside the cell in the film actually got a little bigger. It didn't go away. And it just went down as according to, you know, it just happened at a lower temperature. So here it's T minus T lambda for that particular concentration. And so this is actually, well, it was nice to see that the effect didn't go away when you added helium-3, because that meant maybe it wasn't due to some heat anomaly inside the cell, etc. At the time, we weren't sure what this was that we were seeing because we didn't have a good guidance of the theory. We kept on increasing the amount of helium-3, and unfortunately, in this range, and this is a challenge for experiment, perhaps to improve on this, because it became very difficult, more than 10%, to do the experiment down here, where it becomes very interesting. So in fact, all the way down to about 1 degree, the experiments from 1 degree to something like 1.7 degrees is nearly impossible to do. The equilibrium for one data point was like a day. Whenever you change the temperature, the helium had to re-equilibrate everywhere, and then you measure something and you have to correct for all of these effects, and at the end you didn't believe anything you saw. However, below 1 degree, something fantastic happens. The helium-4 pressure in the vapor almost goes to zero. And so it's almost pure helium-3, so there's hardly any equilibration in terms of concentration ratios in the vapor anymore, and the equilibration actually gets faster below 1 degree. And so we can do experiments there, and in fact, we tried to hit this tricritical point here as accurate as we can by preparing the total mixture to be right. And what we saw is, here's the raw data, and you can see a little bump there. In fact, this is the experimental data. It's actually two sets of data, one where we just took a few points, and one where we tried to do is over a 2 weeks period, take as many points as we could by changing the temperature a little bit at a time. In fact, there's actually, at one point it would look wrong here, so we went back and then it went forward again. because it's really hard to do something like that. You have to be very patient and make sure that nothing bad happened in the laboratory at the same time as you're doing the experiment.
I apologize. I have this question. I just want to make sure I understand. Mm-hmm. The thing that's taking so much time is you're waiting for the H3 and the 3 and 4.
That's right. Yeah. So every
sitting for the film.
It's not only between the film and the bulk.
Yeah.
It's between the liquid and the vapor.
That's slow too.
Yeah, because you have to wait until things evaporate or condense when you change the temperature. And the thing is, you change the temperature, you put a little bit extra heat, then you cool it down. And so then you try to play with, well, let's try to disturb it as low as possible. But then even after you disturb it as low as possible, that means you don't mix. Then it takes even longer for it to diffuse. And you see the film thickness changing over time like this. And the dielectric constant, you know, that's what made the experiment. In fact, when we did these experiments, finally near the tricritical point, we had reduced our cell to just having one capacitor. We actually originally had like 5, but we tried to reduce the vapor volume, and that's what made this experiment manageable, even near the tricritical point. So it took a couple of years to get this curve, essentially. It's the diffusive equilibrium. Not that the thermal equilibrium happens quite quickly, within minutes, but yeah. It turns out that this was a complete mystery to us as to why it would thicken. Because when we look at the papers by Kretsch and Dietrich, they all said that it should thin, just like in the pure helium-4. I guess that the reason was that they said that the boundary conditions would be symmetric. They were saying, well, it should be like a Dirichlet boundary conditions, and so therefore there should be an attractive force. And you know, if you look back at the original papers, but it turns out, well, we were perplexed at the time, but it turns out that Joseph and Indiku saved the day for us. Not only did he say that this chemical potential should be in there for the equilibrium film thickness, but if you look in this conference proceedings, not unlike our own today, he actually discussed this, and he called this the extraordinary boundary condition, which was caused by the fact that, well, there's a pressure due to the van der Waals force, and helium-3 has a lower density than helium-4. So basically, it gets pushed away from the solid surface where the pressure is highest. And in fact, if you calculate these concentration gradients, the first couple of layers is almost pure helium-4, and then very quickly goes down to the bulk concentration in the film. Well, something funny happens along this line, and in fact, it was experiments many years before by Lahert in 1977 that discovered this line over here of phase transitions. And what these line of phase transition, which depends, by the way, on the substrate where this line occurs, underneath this line, there's a thin layer of superfluid that has gone through the Costa-Dowless transition. And so, if you think of this as an XY universality class, Costa-Dowless transition, on the surface you have basically a set of arrows. The boundary condition is a set of arrows that the order parameter has to match, And on the other end, on the vapor interface, there's a helium-3 rich layer, a very, maybe at most one layer thick, where basically the order parameter is going to zero or has a particular value. And this particular set of schizophrenic boundary conditions, which you cannot say that they're opposite anymore, right? Because the opposite would be plus and minus, right? Like helium-4 on one side, helium-3 on the other. Here, the helium-4 on the substrate interface is actually not only helium-4, but helium-4 with a phase added to it, because this is a very strange boundary condition. So in any case, this is what it would look like: a copper surface, a couple layers of solid helium, about a layer and a half or so of superfluid helium, and then normal fluid. So this is what it would be up here: normal fluid, which is almost the bulk concentration. And here's where the fluctuations are happening that causes this thickening of the film.
The experimental signature that concluded that there was this dashed line and explanation?
It was people doing measurements of superfluidity in the film, that you would want to know when it became superfluid. So what they would do is it would have something sort of shaking inside the fluid. And because this first layer became superfluid, it actually happened much higher than when you would have this demixing transition. Right, and so that's why there were two signatures, not just one. And it turns out that it was consistent with the Costa-Dowless transition. So this paper, and I think it was this guy.
They can measure what percentage becomes superfluid.
That's right, yeah. It basically became a KT, sort of like when you measure helium films as well, the Costa-Dowless transition in helium films. You can vary that in the same way, and you can say, oh yes, this is super surface superfluidity, not bulk superfluidity. But in any case, it was actually very interesting that these guys actually thought of this, and so suddenly it became plausible that this should thicken. And in fact, we went back and this is only a subset of the data, these are concentrations close to the tricritical concentration. So this is the purple ones here; those are the ones that I just showed you there that was close to this bulk concentration of helium-3 and 4, right? And so almost all of this is in the bulk liquid. So this is actually the concentration of the bulk liquid, not of the film. And it turns out that this is perhaps important, okay? But nevertheless, there was one calculation by Michael Kretsch at the time, when we were asking, well, could this be? And he did an approximate calculation, and that matched up fairly well. I'll show you in a second a little bit more. But say, had concentrations that were higher, you can see what happened here is that, well, it sort of still matched up over here. Notice that out here, the force doesn't go to zero, at least as calculated from that. But then on the other side, when you had much lower concentration of helium-3, that means you're crossing over here. When you cross this first line, you get a bump. A bump associated with the superfluid transition in the film, and then a second bump over here due to the concentration. And as you approach the tricritical point, these sort of match up. Alright? Now, notice that these don't agree perfectly over here. And the explanation apparently that Kretsch has proposed, this is a, I should have. Somehow I lost the attribution here. This is from Anna Machulik, and I believe it's probably should be on the next slide, their attribution, where they did some Monte Carlo simulations again from the Kretsch group. And this is actually, I grabbed this one off of his seminar from earlier in the year. These are our data over here, which they don't display the part down here. This is their calculation for the tricritical concentration. Notice that it goes to zero on both sides. And it goes sort of sharply up and over here, and this is for the tricritical point. And so, and they call this the vector BEG model, because you have both the helium-4 atoms can have a phase, and the helium-3 atom has no phase but is normal. And so this is this strange Bloom-Emery-Griffiths model. But then over here, what they've plotted on the little dotted green line, which matches our experiment a little bit closer, what this is, a little bit more helium-4 than helium-3. So it's a little bit less than the tricritical concentration. And in fact, if you go back to Professor Dietrich's seminar earlier in the program, he shows you the full set of curves for this. So in any case, I think this issue of the sign of the Casimir force, you know, more interestingly, of course, in more detail, the shape of it, but also in more the most basic part is just knowing the sign. If you know the boundary conditions, if you could, you know, have a mathematical theorem that says if you have this combination of things, this is ever always going to be positive or negative, or do you have to actually solve each individual case for a particular Hamiltonian and order parameter in order to know whether it's plus or minus? I think this would be a great thing to know. Another thing that I mentioned is a Casimir-induced wetting transitions. Let me explain to you what I mean by that. So basically, here's a little diagram of pressure, temperature, and there's a critical point here for just a regular fluid, you know, just Ising model. And this is, you know, an example of a bulk phase transition, you know, going from gas to liquid. But then you might have a confinement as well. Okay, and here's a droplet, you know, showing you confinement. And well, if you add these two, in general, you might get a wetting transition. So there are two kinds of wetting transitions that people talk about. One is a classic type of wetting transition, where you have a droplet over here, and here's the contact angle, is this angle between this tangent here and the surface. And you could go from this situation, which is non-wetting or partial wetting, to a place where you're just complete wetting. Okay, and also the one thing that we ran into more recently as well is a thin-thick or thick-thin coexistence transition, where you go from a uniform thickness film, which is what we were talking about up to now with the helium films, they're always complete wetting, and something where you have a thin film and a thick film together on a surface in apparent equilibrium. And how can you have such a system? First of all, one of the things that I've been working on recently is, can you come up with an expression that gives me the contact angle of a liquid droplet based on the attractive potential due to a surface? Okay? And it turns out, well, you know, you have this Young's equation that perhaps we all learned way back, you know, about describing the contact angle of a fluid in terms of the solid vapor surface tension, the solid liquid surface tension, and the liquid vapor surface tension. And so we can think of these as forces acting on this contact point, the solid vapor surface tension pulling this way, the solid liquid tension pulling that way, and the liquid vapor surface tension pulling up at an angle. And so therefore, if you balance the forces in the horizontal direction, you get this expression. Okay?
Balance them in the vertical direction.
Oh, you don't learn anything there, because you have the extra force that you have to throw in, the reaction force of the substrate that doesn't want to move. So that part isn't as interesting. However, if this point is free to move on the surface, that can move this way, whereas it's sort of limit, it's restricted to move along and not move along this direction. In fact, yeah, and it's completely general, yeah. So, but it's a mnemonic, if you like, to remember what the signs are quickly. Yeah. But then, unfortunately, this difference here is a very difficult thing to calculate in general. You cannot measure them. There's only one experiment in existence, in fact, that has determined, not by measuring directly, but determined all four parameters, and has assigned error bars and shown that it's consistent with this, right? And this is what experiment done by Israel Lechvili some years ago. But that was just a fortuitous accident. Really, you can't measure these things, and so therefore it's not as useful. However, there are approximations that you can make, and this one right here is due to Chen Cole Salmon Trainer. And basically what it says is the difference in these two surface tensions, right, where surface tension is just a free energy per unit area of being in here versus being over there, is that, well, you have to stop, the liquid has to stop near the substrate. So very close to the substrate, there's an excluded layer because the atoms aren't able to penetrate inside the surface, and so therefore it's almost like a gas layer right near the substrate, and so therefore this is the cost of terminating the liquid approximately near the substrate inside here, and so there's an extra interface, but then there's also the fact that this is the cost of doing that, but then there's also the fact that there's more liquid atoms near the substrate than there are in the vapor phase. Right, the more per unit volume, and therefore, if there's an attractive potential, there's a free energy that you gain from the attractive potential. If you integrate this over some film thickness, okay. So for this droplet, it's an infinite film thickness essentially, and this rho is the difference in densities between the liquid and the vapor. Yes.
Isn't rho a function of Z as well?
A V? It could be, yes. So in general, rho should be inside this integral sign, but you know, in this approximation, they assume that it would be almost constant. Yeah. Which after the first couple of layers, it is pretty much near the substrate. And so this is intended to be a perfectly exact expression. Recently, with some communications between Professor Dietrich and some of his collaborators, in fact, I think we may have had a slightly better expression for this, but I'll discuss that in a moment. But in any case, if you put these two equations together, you get this very simple expression due to the contact angle. And in fact, you can see that, well, if there was no attraction to the substrate, suppose that V were zero, or, God forbid, repulsive, right? So V were positive. But let's say it was zero, then you would have cosine theta equals minus one. And that would mean a contact angle of pi, which would mean that the droplet does not wet. It just forms a perfect sphere on the surface, since there's no attraction to the surface. And this is exactly what you expect, because the attraction due to the liquid atoms for each other, they want to just collect together on the surface. On the other hand, as you increase make this V negative and more large in magnitude, right? So big, more and more negative, so that you have more and more attraction to the substrate, well, this minus sign will make this whole term positive. And eventually this reaches a 2. And when this term here reaches a 2, 2 minus 1 is 1, and cosine of theta is equal to 1, and therefore theta equals 0, and that's wetting. Right? So it's actually a very nice expression. But in principle, you should include in here, you know, not only dispersion forces, and you know, maybe you had dipole forces as well, and the van der Waals forces, but you should also have Casimir forces in there, and perhaps even electrostatic forces that you might need to throw in.
I remember remembering one from high school or someplace that can have drops that sort of have theta even greater than so sort of sit up. There are cases like that,
right? Sit up. Maybe we can talk. This is a great thing to maybe discuss. So in particular, let's see what this thing implies for us. Suppose that we started out at some temperature down here. Of course, if you have a droplet, you have to be along this liquid vapor coexistence line, right? And suppose that you have this droplet here that partially wets or doesn't wet at all on the surface, and you increase the temperature. Well, what happens over here? If there is an attraction between the atoms here and the substrate, which if they're van der Waals interactions, is always an attraction, right? And so therefore this is negative, and this is going to have some finite negative value and times a minus one. This whole expression here is going to have a finite positive value. But what happens to this delta rho as you increase the temperature close to the critical point? What happens to the density difference between liquid and vapor? It goes to zero, right? Okay, how about the surface tension? That also goes to zero. Okay, so here we have we have two things that are going to zero. Well, it turns out that rho goes to zero much more slowly than sigma, as it turns out. The critical exponent for sigma is 1.2. The critical exponent for rho, delta rho, whatever, is 0.3. And so therefore this goes to infinity. This term right here, and if this is positive, this minus sign times this integral is positive, this whole term goes to infinity before you get to the critical point. And therefore, at some point, this whole expression will reach 2. And at that point, let's say this is the point here, we call that the wetting temperature, because at that point, the liquid just wets the surface. And since looking at this expression, we've only used the most general properties of fluids and only the fact that they have a net attraction to the surface. This is a completely general prediction, assuming that there aren't any chemical reactions or some other funny things to happen, right? Well,
I have a question. If you continue closer to the critical point, there's no solution. So what does it mean?
Oh, at that point you're just wetting, so that the contact angle can only have a zero value, and then it stops. Yeah, and so that's after that point you just wet. Yeah. Yeah, and in fact the argument that this should happen predates this expression that I just showed you. It was first presented by Kahn and argued by a number of other people since then. The way I put it to people to try to convince them that this is very interesting, in fact, this is why one of the experiments I'm doing right now is trying to see this. All hydrophobic surfaces should become hydrophilic at sufficiently high temperature. Think of it in terms of a wetting droplet of water. Okay? If you have the most hydrophobic surface you love, there's an attraction to it due to the van der Waals forces between the water and that hydrophobic material. It will wet if you increase the temperature. Now, the problem is water has a high critical point, and as you increase, you have to make sure that the water, which becomes like peroxide at high temperature in terms of its reactivity, does not react with the substrate or with anything else, and you know, or you don't have fires and things like that. And the pressure gets very high above 100 degrees. Right, 100 degrees Celsius. You know, in order to keep it along the liquid vapor coexistence, you know, you suddenly they're talking about, you know, 200 atmospheres.
Who's winning as you heat? I just want to make sure I get the answer. Mm-hmm. As you heat this thing up, the interaction energy between the blue stuff and the shaded stuff is increasing.
This prediction is well. Of course, this is a caveat. If the V depends on the temperature. So this could be possibly something that would fix this, right? If you do not have, but this is, the argument only assumes that there's continuously an attraction due to the surface. Even if there were no temperature dependence on the V, you would get it to have a wetting transition, because really what's the difference is that the difference in the density and the liquid vapor surface tension, and that ratio is going to infinity. So as long as the V is positive all along, you would always get a wetting transition. One caveat, though. Before going to that, so recently this expression. By the way, that for some reason nobody have ever thought of writing down this expression before. Here's old data from way back in '88 and '95. Two different experimentalists measuring the contact angle of liquid helium on cesium. There's very surprisingly little data out there in the literature, by the way, for the contact angles as a function of temperature. In any chemical literature, all you find is a contact angle at a temperature. So here's helium on cesium by two different methods, by taking pictures of the droplet as a function of temperature, which is these, and these over here are by capacitance, by capillary rise. And the solid line is the theoretical prediction based on the helium-cesium attraction potential. And these data are particularly for cesium films. The cesium is on gold, and you have to make the cesium very thick so it doesn't see the gold underneath. And then it matches very well. There's a series of other curves that you get when you have more and more gold, right? And then the wetting temperature gets pushed down. But here, you can see that this, although not perfect agreement, certainly the experiments disagree with each other as much as the theory disagrees with the experiment. So you know, this shows you that this equation is actually quite valid over many things.
Does that teach you that the helium is seeing the gold through the cesium?
In general, it does, yeah. In fact, there was a...
use the result to see it.
That's right. Yeah. There was a series of experiments done in at that time frame when people first discovered wetting transitions in for helium on cesium, which is a big deal some years ago, and so people studied this very carefully with Porch microbalances. But that's why that data exists in such great detail for that one system. For the Casimir force and binary mixture films, I mentioned Fukuto, and most recently, you know, with his AFM measurement of Dietrich group. In any case, here's Massa's thing. So here's the chemical potential difference from the bulk, and so that controls the film thickness before. It's sort of like us varying the height in our experiment. They actually vary the chemical potential by causing a temperature gradient between two different parts of their cell, the bulk liquid and the film. But in any case, it's the same physics overall. And what they saw is this massive thickening. I mean, look at this. This is 80 to 130. This is huge. And what this proves, this experiment very nicely, is that, in fact, Casimir forces can be as big as van der Waals forces. And if van der Waals forces cause things to wet or undergo wetting transitions, Casimir forces, it would seem, especially at room temperature, because the Casimir force is proportional to T, they get very big. And so therefore, they should be able to cause wetting transitions at room temperature, you know, in some room temperature experiments. Over here I showed, actually, this is one theoretical calculation over here for this critical point that I saw in Dietrich's talk, where this is the same curly theta over here obtained from these data, and these are one of the theoretical calculations. So it actually is consistent with the theory. Yeah, these are experimental data.
Yeah, and the other two are two approximations. So medical data are different. Or medical data are different. So.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I will show them Wednesday.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, therefore, this is an advertisement for Wednesday's talk. So, however, you know, for those of us who were right around the time that we published our first experiment in '99, there was this other experiment that I was aware of that claimed to see evidence for the critical Casimir force in a binary liquid mixture. However, there was something funny with it. Well, their experiments were limited to only above the critical point in this mixture. And in particular, for below the critical point, what they saw was droplets form on the surface. And therefore, you know, they said, well, we can't do the experiment anymore. You know, they got all sorts of crazy data there. Okay? Again, when they calculated this scaling function, it was 150 times, you know, two orders of magnitude smaller than the theory predicted. Okay? And so this made everybody suspicious, and some people blame the discrepancy with theory on the fact that maybe they had temperature gradients in their cell, or they didn't. There was something wrong with the way they did their ellipsometric measurements or something like that. That slide got. I'm going to go back to the previous slide, by the way. I just got them mixed up in order. Here's a hypothesis that I like to propose, and although I haven't worked out the details of it, okay, it's a different mixture system than was used by Massa and Fukuto and Dietrich most recently for their experiments, where the film completely wet the surface. In their case, there was something that perhaps below the critical point did not wet. Were they perhaps seeing a wetting transition caused by a Casimir force? All right. Maybe if we were able to, you know, put two and two together, we can figure out, you know, in fact, maybe their experiment saw exactly what it had to see, because they were seeing a wetting transition for caused by the critical Casimir force near the binary critical point. By the way, most recently, Lothar Schmiel and Sigurd Dietrich and my student and I, well, we've been communicating privately as to, you know, whether, you know, discussing a recent paper of mine. And you know, here's the expression I showed you earlier, essentially, but corrected for, suppose that in that expression I showed you earlier, I assume that the film over here was essentially zero thickness, that there was no liquid, you know, there's non-wetting, and so therefore that film should be very, very thin. How about if this film actually had a finite thickness next to this droplet? And in fact, this is important because, it occurred to Dietrich and Lothar, mostly because they've been studying second-order wetting transitions. Right, first-order wetting transitions are like I showed you, where you have this sharp kink in the angle as a function of temperature. You go to zero and then you stop at zero. A second-order wetting transition is very smooth, and so therefore the free energy doesn't have a jump, right, at the transition temperature. Well, in fact, this is probably the better expression. The difference is that now we have a D here instead of a Z min. Well, the Z-min is the closest approach to the surface. So now this is the additional thickness. And now you also have a correction here due to the atom-atom interaction in the fluid. So this is sort of like a correction to the surface tension. And perhaps this may be the better expression for a second-order wetting transition. So that's something to keep in mind, too, right? Which is, if you want to talk about that, I'm still trying to figure out the details of that. Okay, so... the last question that I posed. By the way, are we doing okay on time? My clock is wrong because I'm on the wrong coast. Okay. Can we observe Casimir forces in liquid crystalline films? Okay. And there've been a number of attempts in the past, and I can't review them all here. Basically, people tried to use AFM and things like that to detect it, but in the end, they ended up seeing capillary condensation phenomena, where they get one phase of the liquid crystal to capillary condense in between usually a sphere and a solid surface, and they end up measuring that phenomenon instead of the Casimir force. My interest, well, I'll explain in a second. And so here are the various kinds of liquid crystal states, you know, just a smattering of them. You can have smectic, where you have this one-dimensional crystal ordering, or you can have a pneumatic. And these are cigar-shaped liquid crystals, which are the types that I'll discuss in a moment. At very low temperature, you can have crystal. The pneumatic doesn't have crystal order in any direction, but on average, they're oriented in a certain direction. And then isotropic just behaves like an ordinary fluid with the same properties in all directions, right? So this will be birefringent, different viscosities in different directions, etc. And way back in 99, people first noticed that there was some wetting transition occurring in this film. And right away, since back in 99, this is when we published our things on Casimir forces, and etc. Primo Zurl is a theorist that was visiting the U.S., and he immediately tried to interpret this as due to the Casimir force, right? That this would be an instance of the Casimir force causing a wetting transition. Here's essentially a super. We repeated their experiments, and also here is included their data. And I think their data is the squares, and mine are the circles, but you can't really tell them apart too well. Unimportant. Around 35 degrees, you get this isotropic phase up here, going in the bulk to a pneumatic phase. But this is a phase diagram of the coverage over here in nanometers versus temperature for the film. And for the film, what you see is inside this gray area, you see a thick yellow film and thin areas. And for a particular temperature, the thin is at a particular thickness, and the thick is at a particular thickness. So it's like two film thicknesses in coexistence with each other, like liquid and vapor phases on a surface. And, well, if you're a critical phenomena person, you know, you say, well, two different states on a surface, you start thinking Ising models and things like that. But, you know, there's how about even explaining why this thin and thick happens? I'll show you some movies of these things in a bit. And let's see if we, I don't know if this will play. Okay, and let me, which case? Okay. So here we're increasing the temperature's on the bottom, and we're increasing the temperature. This is over like a 12-hour period, but we just like taking snapshots at different times. And this is how, as we increase the temperature along this curve. And so I'll let it play one more time, and I'll repeat what's going on. But basically, you have thin and thick areas, and I'll go back to the phase diagram and show you exactly what happened. So here you're increasing the temperature. It's a 60-nanometer film in uniform everywhere at the beginning. And now you get these thin spots. And as you increase the temperature, the area covered by the thin spots increases. Okay, and the area covered by the thick areas decreases. The thick areas are getting thicker, and the thin areas are simultaneously getting thicker. And in the end, the thin areas cover the entire surface, and they're the original film thickness that you started with. Right, so basically you're looking at reflected color through a microscope, and that reflected color is just Newton's rings type colors, and it gives you information on the film thickness. So again, as you increase the film thickness, this is what you see for this 5 CB film. And it's just a cigar-shaped liquid crystal on the surface of silicon, right? So let's add, okay. So what do we see here? So what we saw is initially there's a film, and it's in a pneumatic phase, and various things can tell you that things are oriented more or less in this pneumatic fashion inside the film. And then you go through a coexistence range where you have both thick and thin, and then you go into this isotropic.
This is something
that we have to think about a little bit more carefully, it turns out, but the conventional wisdom with the preferences of these liquid crystals is that near the surface of the substrate, they tend to try to lay flat. And this is due to the fact that they're somewhat bulky, and they have large benzene rings on them. And so they try to lay flat. On the other hand, near the vapor interface, because the vapor has very low dielectric constant compared to the silicon, they try to be homeotropic or perpendicular to the surface. And so therefore you have have a gradient in this director, which is sort of giving you the average direction inside the film. And so therefore, you also have a mean field force in addition to any possible Casimir force. And it's the combination of the two that would lead to wedding behavior. And in fact, this and the thing is, this isotropic to nematic transition is a weekly first order transition. There's lots of fluctuations in it, but it nevertheless it's first order. And so you say, well, you know, maybe this is not the Casimir force. And in fact, there were a number of explanations. The number of explanations that did not involve the Casimir force at all, that it was just due to this stresses inside the film. By the way, we were just going up to 60 nanometers. This is where we hit here, and we were in the thick film state. This is, you've got some thin film areas. As you increase the temperature, the thick film increases, and the thin film also increases. And so you're going up in temperature until eventually, since the coverage on the surface is constant, you emerge over here where the thin film has now covered the entire surface, because you have sort of a level rule. So this diagram explains everything you just saw in that picture, in terms of two film thicknesses that are always in equilibrium. As you go up this way, you have the two different film thicknesses that are in equilibrium are different, but the average coverage is the same over the entire surface. All right, this is what I just described to you a little earlier. And in fact, when one of the arguments that people presented earlier is that, in fact, if the film is very thin, that the surface, that these liquid crystals will be oriented in an isotropic manner, because if you have these two tendencies conflicting with each other, so if you have a very thin film, they would sort of like randomize each other. The liquid crystal wouldn't know which way to point. And so they had, and this would happen below a certain critical film thickness, which they called D sub C. When the film is greater than this D sub C, then you would get a gradient that you could see between the two interfaces. And in a similar fashion to what I showed you earlier for the liquid vapor system, for the helium system, when you had the bulk liquid as one phase, you know, one state, and the thin film in equilibrium with it, here you can have the two areas inside the one surface. And this is important because in liquid crystals they have a very large viscosity. These islands form over minutes, you can see this phenomena happen in the surface over hours. You know, they're there, but the two film thicknesses establish themselves over minutes. The islands themselves gather themselves each other. You know, there's probably a one-dimensional surface tension that gathers the droplets together, but there's no gravity pulling them together like in a true liquid vapor system, and so therefore they very slowly merge into one big droplet. But in any case, you can write, you know, a free energy, but now F1 is going to be a different free energy here than there, and then you're going to have an F2, and I'm just, you know, again, it's heuristic. If you want to throw in the details, you have to throw them in. There's the van der Waals attraction due to each one, depending on the area. There's this elastic part over here through the gradient in the film. And then we want to conserve the total volume of liquid crystal. And again, this is an approximation for liquid crystal because there's slightly different volumes, but it's really small. And when you minimize this, you get a certain expression that depends on 1 over d squared. And in fact, this 1 over d squared is consistent with the shape of that phase diagram that I showed you earlier. Okay, so that was their argument, that this explained that. And in fact, this is the actual paper right over here by Van and Fenter and Valignat. And this is, you know, throwing in, you know, real expressions for F1 and F2, and not just, you know, trying to make it simple so you can put it on a slide. And this is the line minus view me view. And so these are the two film thicknesses that are in equilibrium with each other at this particular temperature. And so this is, you know, they got results that, you know, plotted very nicely. This is the PRL diagram that they got. And you can see that it matches very nicely. It's a total theory. But, well, It turns out that, you know, the Benaventure over here and Zero over there, they had different ideas as to what the equilibrium configuration of the thin film should be. They think it should be like this, in fact. When you get very thin, that the boundary condition at the air is much stronger than at the silicon and would just make the whole thing orient this way, not the way that they, in their model, assumed over there. Furthermore, they said, well, look at this. Look how many degrees you're posing that this, that, you know, they, essentially their model said that this is the isotropic phase all the way through here, because we use the free energy, the bulk free energy for isotropic films for the thin film state, and the bulk free energy for pneumatic for the thick film state in that equation. However, look how many degrees, you know, 6 degrees below the bulk transition, you're posing that you have an isotropic phase. And they said this is unlikely. They, from their thermodynamic considerations, you cannot have a metastable isotropic phase that low in temperature in order to construct that free energy diagram. And so this has been very controversial in the literature. They almost yell at each other.
Yes, so I think these Fenerol's equations were continuously varying anisotropy.
That's right, yeah.
So they're actually taking a kind of an epsilon, and then it varies with position, and it's
an isotropic. These guys over here, they blame this completely on the Casimir force. These guys think it's just Wien field forces, although they say, well, maybe it must have some also some gradient forces as well, but only due to this difference, not due to something that...
I wasn't even getting to the gradient force. I was getting to the fact that you have anisotropic media.
Right, yeah.
And then you put that into the calculation of the Vandermeer interactions.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think they didn't do that.
This came of only elastic energies being computed.
You don't think it would help?
I don't know if you know anything about interactions in sufficient detail.
If you know the birefringence,
If you knew the birefringence, you could distinguish immediately whether it's
isotropic. Unfortunately, when you do it on a different substrate, then it's different, these are what these molecules look like. We did some experiments with 8 CB rather than 5 CB, and I'll show you why this one's a more interesting one to do it. In particular, one of the arguments about 5 CB is that it actually isn't completely stable on the surface. It actually de-wets over time, over a day or two. Whereas 8 CB, as it turns out, is very, very stable on the surface. You just put it on there and make a film, and as long as you don't change the temperature, you can store it for like a couple of weeks and do the experiment if you want. It's very nice. The only difference between 5 CB and 8 CB is that it's just an old longer alkyl chain on one versus the other. But this small difference leads to 8 CB having a smectic A phase, just above room temperature. So at room temperature, you prepare it, and it's actually the smectic phase where they line up perpendicular to the surface. And then you have a pneumatic phase around 33.5, and then you have an isotropic phase around 40. So it's very convenient for experiment because it's just above room temperature. So it's very nice to do experiments on these. People, if you plunk some of this on the surface, it actually spreads out, and you can actually see the layers as it's spreading out. Near the substrate, you actually get the molecules in 8 CB are actually these dimers. They actually dimerize together where their heads are the benzene rings that almost overlap over here. And so they actually act like one whole layer. So it's like a bilayer or something, but not quite, because they're actually wiggling in place. Except for the first layer. The first layer is almost horizontal on a slight angle to the substrate, and it forms, essentially, it's part of your substrate. Like this, if you like, in a big sense, your substrate starts here, and then everything sort of goes there. And also, this has an angle here, but these are actually flipping around. The tail is actually, you know, there's nothing holding it at an angle. It's actually, you know, making a nice cone due to thermal motion. So it's actually, you know, pretty much the order is only this way. To prepare it, we just use a spinner. This thing just spins is the typical way that people make things for semiconductors and things like that. You just use a thing, drip your solution, actually use that in chloroform. You just make a 1% solution in chloroform. You drip it onto the substrate, turn on the thing, have it spin up to a certain acceleration. It turns out that it evaporates so fast that it's controlled by the acceleration what your final thickness is. And depending on the acceleration, which is, I believe it's... rotations per second or something like that. it's a funny unit. But in any case, you get something that you can predict what film thickness you actually will get within 7%. This is the phase diagram you get for HCB. And again, what makes it really interesting is this the transition from the smectic A to the pneumatic phase is a second order phase transition in bulk. There's no first order latent heat, although of course it could be in the film. We don't know that yet. But in any case, so you would expect that, well, maybe this over here would you know, might have contributions due to the Casimir force. I'm not sure. Above this line over here, it's unstable. It actually de-wets. But below this line, as long as you stay below this line, you can go up and down and see reproducible results. What you see over here is, I'll show you a few movies. One movie, I'm going to start over here and go up, and it'll look just like the 5CB, except that you'll notice the colors will be slightly different because it's a different molecule, right? Different film thicknesses, and so some of them are a little bit harder to see, especially the very thick one. Then if you go up this way, and there's a little bump here, what you'll see is as you go in the temperature, you get some thin film, and then over here, the film will increase, and then it'll decrease again. It'll go to zero, and it becomes uniform again. You see, uniform, and then you hit this part over here, and then at this point, it looks just like 5CB, where you get the thin film, and the thin film eventually covers the entire surface. Or you can go down this way, and here you get some thick film. The thick film increases in proportion, then it decreases, it gets a minimum, and then the thick film decreases again, and you get all thin film. So you start with thin film, you get some thick film, then you get some less, and then more, depending on the shape of this, that the total coverage is constant. So, I mean...
And the semantics, etc., are based on what?
What's that?
The road you have... written on the phase diagram, semantic, pneumatic, etc.
These are bulk temperatures, not in the film. And in fact, this is one of the things that we're working on right now, is actually determining, based on our preliminary measurements, depending on where you are in that phase diagram, there are different phases. It's not merely just going across, and so therefore it would be nice to plot that line. Where does that smectic to pneumatic line go in the film? Where does it go in the bulk? For the pneumatic to isotropic. And in fact, near the top, there's some data, and it suggests that it's very close, hugging the pneumatic to isotropic phase transition from the one data that we have out there. It says that it comes down this way. But then again, it was for a different substrate, et cetera, so it could be that there's some error there, and it was an extrapolation from measurements that were done out here. So it could be that it actually goes down this way, and this would be consistent with what they saw in 5CB. In 5CB, they said that, well, this was essentially an extension to two dimensions of the pneumatic to isotropic phase transition, where rather than being infinitely thin, and so you wouldn't just see a difference there, it would now in the surface, it would look like this thin and thick phases, and it would be one pneumatic and one isotropic. Although, as I suggested earlier, some people claim that, well, this should not be able to be isotropic all the way out here. But nevertheless, here is a different situation, and so it would be actually, you know, there's no theory right now for this, and so, you know, it would be important to figure out whether perhaps there might be some Casimir forces in there or not. But certainly this shape is very interesting, and so, in fact, We're getting some new equipment that will be able to measure the shape a little bit more accurately, so you don't have as much scatter. These are many, many data points. But nevertheless, it also seeing where these, does the pneumatic, does it perhaps go like this and hit that right at the end, or doesn't it? I'm not sure. So in this film here, let's try to play this movie now. And did it open it? I saw something. No? I don't see anything. Let me. Huh? Not quite sure why that isn't playing automatically. Or is it playing? Oh, I just don't see it. It's already open. Yeah, it's in back. Oh, okay, it says error or something. Don't move up. Okay. Yeah, now it's catching back to where I was earlier as I tried to play the movie 15 times because I didn't see the error message. Okay, let it start. All right, now, so you actually see some texture on there, and that's because if you don't have a perfect layer, since it's in the smectic layer at the beginning, you, depending on the exact film thickness, average film thickness or coverage that you get on the surface, you get like a half layer. And a half layer ends up being bumps, since you're actually seeing a half layer thickness there in terms of those bumps. As you increase the temperature, it becomes uniform, though. And so I think this is where it actually becomes pneumatic in the film. Remember, this is the thicker one. And, we skipped some of the temperatures because nothing's happening in terms of putting it in the movie. But then eventually we get to this synthetic coexistence line. And so you see, again, a few islands over here. It's not as easy to see on the 5CB because it's a very thick film. So there, and notice that the thin gradually covers the entire surface until everything's originally. We did X-ray measurements comparing the original film thickness and the film thickness and all the way up in the isotropic phase, and they're within error of each other. So the average coverage stays constant over the surface. Okay. And okay, and here is now a 60. So now that you notice that the original color is a little thinner, we didn't muck around with the colors at all. We could always try to make it look nicer for the movies, but we just wanted to show you the actual data as it comes out. So this one here. Oh, I fucked. I clicked the wrong one. Okay, yeah. So something. I'm not able to. Okay, so we had 8CB 50, okay. Okay, so it's lighter color as of before. But again, you get some islands as you enter the coexistence near the bottom. And then the islands get bigger and they get the maximum, then they go away. So it eventually goes. And so part of the reason that the scatter is bigger there is that the percent of the surface that's covered by the thin islands is smaller, so it's harder to tell when it begins and ends that the whole area. But now you saw the very uniform film in between. Now at the end, you get to the top, and you hit that coexistence region, and again the thin now increases until it covers the entire surface. So at very, it was crossed a little bump in the phase diagram down here. You first saw the thin areas appear, they grew up to a maximum, and then they disappeared. And then you had a uniform area, and then you increase the temperature higher, and then suddenly you get the thin areas increase in percentage area until they cover the entire surface.
Boundaries are reproducible if you cool down rather than heat up?
The two film thicknesses are, but the actual distribution depends how big the islands are and how they're distributed on the surface changes each time you go up and down. And in particular, it's different going up and down, the distribution. It also even depends on how fast you go in. If you jump right into the middle and you wait there for a little while, then it takes a little while and then it appears. You get a different distribution if you go back and come back again. So the kinetics sort of determine the shapes. And how many islands you get, etc. Whereas the if you go really fast, you get lots of little islands. If you go really slow, you only get one big island or something. And maybe if you wait a little long, if you got many islands, the little islands would join together. So it's a little bit confusing that way. Okay, so now finally, I'm going to show you. Okay. So this is now going through the bottom section. So now you see that the film overall is thin. So now you get thick. These are thick areas because you're going off on the left side of the phase diagram. And so you notice that the thick areas go to a maximum. And then eventually, since we're going to exit on the thin side as well, on the top, eventually these thick islands have to go away. But you'll notice that they actually never overall cover the entire area because it only goes this way and then it goes back out the other way. So. So depending on your initial coverage, you get completely different looking behavior. And in fact, when we first saw this, I didn't understand what was going on. And I presented this at a March meeting, and I still was trying to figure out what was different about this and the 5CV experiment. And Masa Fukuta, who's one of my collaborators in doing this, he says, oh, it makes completely a lot of sense based on your phase diagram. And so we thought about it and he said, oh, okay. And it does. Okay, so back to our talk over here. Oops, wrong. That's why. Okay. So... Oh, okay, I guess we closed this by accident. There we are. Yeah, all right. Apologize for... Oh, okay, this is... We are there. I was confused. Okay, so again, these are... Since I skipped the movies, I didn't realize... Okay, so what we saw there is first I showed you going this way, and then you get this thin film, and as you increase, eventually you leave out the same film thickness, but now you're on the thin film side. So you enter on the thick film, and you leave out on the thin film side. The second film was with like 50. You enter over here, you get some of the thin film. Since you're at 50 is actually a little bit less than the minimum here, you actually get some thick film. As you increase, the thick film increases... you start here, you get some thin film. The thin film, you start here, you get some of this thin film. As you increase over here, you get more of this thin film than you get of the thick film. Eventually, you leave out and you end up all of this of the thick film side. Then it's uniform until you hit here, then you make the thin film, and as you increase, the percentage that's thick increases until you covered. Then the last one, you start at around 30. Here, now you start on the thin film side. You make some thick film that increases and then decreases and goes to zero. And those are, now you would say, well, let's calculate that to see what makes difference. So you would expect that if the coverage is constant overall, that this average film thickness is just the film thickness on the low side of that phase diagram times the fraction of the area covered by the low thickness side, plus D, the film thickness on the phase diagram on the high side, times the fraction on the high side. And so here for several film thicknesses, this D equals 60 actually has two places, you know, on the bottom and near the top. So the near the top matches really well. Here's the one that was 30, I believe. Well, this one says 38. And here, this one is one that was 70. And so, well, the error bars are different for different things because depending on how close you're one to one side or the other, you get, if the error scatter is big and you're on near, very close to here, then you're going to have a big error bar due to how close you are to that right side. And therefore, that propagates through. But what this diagram is we assume that the left side is known perfectly well, and we calculated along different trajectories what the percentage should be on the right side based on the islands that we saw along that trajectory. And you can see that, well, in general, they give us the shape of the phase boundary pretty well. You know, so they agree, not perfectly, but for pretty good. You know, we were trying to be honest with our error bars. We have a setup over at Brookhaven National Lab where we got a specialized cell. There's a camera up here that looks down on our cell, so we can do that simultaneous optical and X-ray scattering. And to the extent that we have very nice X-ray data, these oscillations over here give us the film thickness overall on any particular thing. Unfortunately, X-ray doesn't give us the isn't as good for seeing what's happening inside each island, because it takes the average, especially at certain things. And so we're actually developing some ellipsometry techniques at WPI. But this is, for instance, I'll show you what we can do with X-ray is where it's uniform. You know, when you only have one film thickness, we can tell what the structure is. And so, for instance, this is how this is the X-ray reflectivity as a function of Q inverse, which I got smudged there. What you see here, these oscillations are due to the film thickness. This peak here is a Bragg peak due to the smectic layers. And in fact, you can calculate the electron density from this data over here. You can model it, and what you see here is that near the substrate there's this heightened electron density due to the substrate. Then you have essentially oscillations in the electron density, and in fact they have the same period as the double smectic layer. However, for this particular film, when you have this behavior over here, notice the previous diagram. Over here, this was just the same film at different temperatures. At very high temperatures, you get just a very small bump out here. That smectic peak goes away. And in fact, what you get there is you get smectic-type ordering near the substrate, and it appears that you do not have it near the vapor interface anymore. And so this was giving us information about the boundary conditions. And so this is still very much a work in progress. That we have a pile of data that I'm still analyzing with X-rays that we already have. But we also are going back to do some more data, and we'll get a fuller picture of this phase diagram and what the actual likely boundary conditions are at different points in that phase diagram, which would be very interesting to know, especially in terms of interpreting Casimir forces. In principle, you can, yeah. Although it's more difficult than the smectic ordering, but yeah, we should be able to tell average ordering inside the film. Yes. Oh no. Okay. Well. In any case, from these things here, this is just summarizing the conclusions for that I've just stated for the liquid crystal films. It's unclear, and liquid crystals are sort of, in a sense, messy systems to study, in that they have lots of details. At the same time, they present you with an opportunity to look at very different kinds of phase transitions, and in particular, the SMECTIC A to the MANIC ordering is an XY universality class phase transition, just like liquid helium. So, in a sense, there's a connection between helium and liquid crystals, right? And so perhaps, you know, some things may be similar, some things may be different. But nevertheless, it allows you to explore other boundary conditions that would not be allowed for liquid helium. Liquid helium, you just get the boundary conditions that Mother Nature gave you, which is this Dirichlet boundary conditions at both interfaces. Liquid crystal, though, now you can actually impose, perhaps by the choice of your substrate, or, you know, you can do a number of things, you can choose different boundary conditions. And then, therefore, this brings the question is, well, can we even tell even the sign of the Casimir force for a particular set of boundary conditions ahead of time? Furthermore, this is kind of wetting transition that I showed you here, is this thin, thick equilibrium on the surface, is a very different kind of phase transition, and, you know, we only confirmed this in 8CB after people were wondering whether the phenomenon seen in 5CB some years ago in 2003 were actually genuine, and we saw it in 8CB, which is a very stable system that completely does away with all the objections that people had for 5CB, and we still see the same thing. At the same time, 8CB has this new unique feature, which is this SMECTIC to pneumatic phase transition, which is presumably second order in the bulk. And, well, this may also give us an opportunity to see something else. Okay, I don't know. But in any case, that is my pitch for the things that I think might be worthy of discussion.